Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm speaking to a British journalist and non-fiction writer whose focus is on psychology, behaviour and wilderness. He was previously a science journalist and spent 6 years as a senior editor at New Scientist. He's written for The New York Times, The FT, Nature, BBC Future, Slate, The Observer, Prospect and The Times. He currently teaches writing as a Royal Literary Fund Fellow at Oxford Brookes University. And his latest book is Fans, A Journey into the Psychology of Belonging. It takes a fascinating look at the history of fandom. Michael Bond, welcome to Monocle Reads.
Thank you very much.
There's another Michael Bond.
Oh, yes. Don't I know it?
Do people ask you about Paddington all the time?
Quite a lot. And I understand he was an absolutely charming, charming man. So I don't mind being mixed up with him.
And a very rich one,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, well, he did well.
He did extremely well. So can I ask, are you a fan of Paddington?
Well, that's an interesting question. I suppose I was as a child without realising it. You know, I was pretty addicted to those stories.
How would you define fandom?
Well, I think it's quite simple, really. I mean, being a fan is just loving something. And being part of a fandom is loving something that other people love. I think it's as simple as that. And fans, I mean, I think it's a self-defining concept. If you think you're a fan, then you're a fan. I mean, I think there's a public perception, a common perception of being a fan is generally quite negative. There's a stereotype that fans are not just passionate but obsessive, possibly mindless, irrational in pursuing their passions. But in reality, I mean, when you look inside fandoms and talk to fans, there are possibly two things going on. One, being part of that group of other fans who share your interest, that sense of belonging is really crucial. And you find that across all kinds of fandoms, all genres, that sense of being part of a group with people who love the thing that you love. And the other thing about being a fan is the relationship that you have with your icon or hero, which can be, you know, pretty deep and enduring.
Mm. You start the book comparing the fandoms of Dickens, of Arthur Conan Doyle, and of J.K. Rowling. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the differences there.
The differences are hard to discern because they're so similar. I mean, people would queue up in the street for the latest iteration of the Sherlock Holmes story in the same way that children queued up outside bookshops for the latest Harry Potter book. I think the fact that those children and those fans of Sherlock Holmes were idolising a fictional person doesn't make that relationship any less meaningful, because those kind of characters, they hold aspects of, you know, human emotions, values, principles. People find it very easy to connect to them, whether it was in the 19th century or today.
Mm. So the word fan, I guess, comes from fanatic.
Yeah, that seems to be the derivation, which is slightly unfortunate because it's retained that slightly extremist negative implication. I don't think you have to be a fanatic to be a fan. I think it's quite a normal thing, really. It's a normal, common state of being, just having a passion, a fascination with something that you gain a lot out of.
Mm. How much of it is about the group experience, not just about you liking a thing or a person, but about a whole group of people doing it simultaneously?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. And you talk to fans and about why they're part of their fandom, and they will start to talk about discovering other people who share their interests. And being a fan by yourself can be a lonely thing, particularly if your interest is slightly niche. You might be embarrassed about it, and you know, it's difficult to share something when you think you might be judged. But when people find others who have that similar passion, then all those fears and restrictions, you know, just fall away. You're in a room of people, online or in real life who you don't have to worry about talking about these things and sharing arcane knowledge. Mm. It's
I mean, it goes the other way too. You write that group prejudice has played a role in some of the most important events of human history. It affects many of the decisions we make every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this affection for being part of a group, the need, the impulse really to belong to a group is part of human nature and has been for hundreds of thousands of years, even our pre-human evolutionary history. That was a very common imperative. Everyone wants to belong to something, and the groups that we do belong to are important for our sense of who we are. It's difficult to imagine ourselves without those groups. And inevitably, there's a lot of positives about being part of a group, but being in a group sometimes means that you have prejudices against people who aren't in your group or in other groups, and that in-group out-group conflict is an ancient story. But you do find it in fandoms, of course, but it very often, I was surprised at just how positive fandoms can be and how beneficial, and you don't have to have that antagonism with that in-group feeling. It can work without it.
Mm. Although when you look at things like, say, supporters of football teams or Brexiteers and Remainers or MAGA and Democrats.
Yeah, it depends on the context. I mean, sport is a good example because, well, in football, you know, one team's there's going to be a winner and a loser always, but that doesn't apply to other fandoms. I think it's not much different between sporting fandoms and pop culture fandoms, but there is perhaps a higher potential for conflict just because of the nature of the game, if you like.
Yeah. You talk about fictional friends or parasocial relationships. Tell us more about that.
A parasocial relationship is what psychologists call a relationship that is one-sided, so which is typically a relationship between a fan and their idol. It's like there are two people in the relationship, but only one of them realizes it. But it's still a relationship, even though you don't get a response from your hero. They can still form a really important part of your life and thinking, because people tend to be drawn to heroes who reflect something about them, perhaps a similar personality or set of values, or they might see a common experience or a narrative of suffering sometimes, or they just aspire to be like this person. So when you're drawn to someone and connect on that intimate level, the relationship does become pretty meaningful and powerful.
But you never get anything back from that person.
No, but fans understand that.
Mm. And they can never be rejected.
Well, they can never be rejected, exactly. And I mean, there are occasions when if you expect you're going to get something back, you expect too much from your hero, then that's when being a fan can be troublesome and can lead to pathology. But I heard so many stories of how people just really benefited from having that parasocial relationship. I mean, one example, there's a woman, I didn't actually meet her myself, but she was part of a study, a psychologist who I was talking to, and this woman was in her 50s and she had lost her husband and was finding it very difficult to move on. She was grieving for several years and didn't imagine she'd ever have another relationship. And then she started to get very interested in the American singer Josh Groban, went to a lot of his gigs, became part of his fandom and developed a crush on him. And she knew that, you know, this was kind of inappropriate in that he was never going to reciprocate, she was never going to meet him probably, but she found that incredibly useful for her because it demonstrated that she could have these feelings for another person again, these romantic feelings, and it gave her the confidence to go out and you know, look for another life. Mm. And that's a great example of how a parasocial relationship can help people.
Yeah. You have a whole chapter about Jane Austen.
Yes, because I live in Hampshire, the Jane Austen's county So a lot of her fans were on my doorstep while I was researching the book. So I spent a lot of time with them. And it's a vast fandom.
And yet she lived 200 years ago. It's extraordinary.
Yes, that's right. But her fans find her totally relevant to their lives today. And most of her fans are female. The fans that I spent a lot of time with were in their early 20s. You know, that's not the stereotype of a Jane Austen fan. But these young women, they read her novels, they knew her characters very well, and they would really connect with someone like Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, for example, a character who was extremely courageous in the way she stood up against the patriarchal norms of that era and was brave enough to turn down two offers of marriage at a time when marriage was often the only route to financial security. And for those young women today, that is a great model of how it is possible to be independent and not to submit to the norms that you might think oppress you.
Mm. And of course, when she first started writing, or when she first became popular, people would have just read her work. But now social media is here. That must have changed fandom completely.
Yeah, it did. But I mean, it changed perhaps the intensity, the level of engagement. It made it easier for people to find others who shared their interest. But I mean, these Jane Austen fans, a lot of them found each other at a Regency event or, you know, the annual parade in Bath. So it doesn't all happen online. And of course, people, even if they find themselves online, these fandoms, they put great emphasis on meeting up in person. And the Jane Austen fans, they love getting together, dressing up in Regency outfits, having picnics in the grounds of country houses, this kind of reenacting those scenes. Surprisingly, though, they're not all expert on all things Jane Austen. There's some of them know all the novels and all the characters. Some of them haven't read half the novels. But what they love is being with other people who share that interest.
And what about things like the Beatles or Elvis Presley or even some K-pop stars? And you see footage of those concerts with people literally screaming and crying and trying to get close to them. What's that about?
Well, have you ever been to a football match? I mean, I
don't think it's...
Yeah. I don't think there's any difference between teenage girls screaming at an Ed Sheeran concert and men and boys screaming at a Liverpool match. I mean, it's the same passion. They love something. They're doing it together. And yet, the interesting thing is the way those different fandoms are portrayed in the sort of public consciousness and in the media. Those teenage girls screaming at a concert, they tend to be derided as something mindless and unthinking, and their behaviour is considered inappropriate. But, you know, the fans at a football match, that's considered something honourable. Or, you know, the more extreme you are in that situation, the more you get applauded. Mm. And so the question is, you know, who decides what is appropriate in that kind of behaviour? And it's obviously not the teenage girls. You know, they don't have any kind of platform. So I think that tells you something about the way fans and fandoms are received by.
There's an extraordinary chapter about people who believe they're animals.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this, the bear, for instance.
The bear. So this is a group of people who are known as Therians. They are people who feel that they are in some way an animal or part animal. And this is entirely sincerely held belief. And it's not just a belief, it's something that they actually feel in their body. They grow up feeling that something is not right, and they experience phantom body parts where there shouldn't be. And these body parts are representative of some animals, and they feel they have some kind of a tail, or their mouth feels like the shape of a snout, or they feel they have fur on their skin. And this, it's difficult to understand neurologically what's going on because they haven't been properly studied. But these people, they certainly do not advertise themselves. And they basically keep themselves very quiet, because trying to share that kind of experience with others invites scorn, mockery. And it was, I found it very, very difficult persuading them to take part in this and to be interviewed because they were just nervous about it. But once they were reassured that it would be anonymous and I was going to take them at their word, and they were very forthcoming and open. And it's just a fascinating group of people. Above all, they have managed to define themselves online. That's a great example of how the internet has helped people, because previously they would have been very isolated, but they have online managed to link up with other people who have the same kind of feeling experiences as them. And that has been an immense relief. These people who felt rejected from society suddenly in a situation where they can share their extraordinary feelings and experiences with others.
What about it the other way around? People who are the object of fandom, what is it like for them, for being Taylor Swift or somebody?
Yeah, I didn't actually spend a lot of time talking to the stars because I was focusing mainly on the fans, but I did look at some cases of where fanishness had gone into something much more extreme and pathological. And that situation for a star can be terrifying. You know, having a stalker turn up in your bedroom or being persistently threatened online, that happens all the time. And you don't require many pathological fans to feel threatened as a star. So it can make life extremely uncomfortable. And of course, social media has made them much more vulnerable to that, because if you're a pop star, you need to use it, but you also open yourself up to abuse, and people can find you in that way. So there is that dark side to it.
And there's also the dark side where people, so for instance, serial killers or prisoners, murderers, seem to attract fans.
Yes, they do. And to give an example, there's a group of young, disaffected young men who have a fascination with school shooters. So particularly the two boys, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, who killed 12 pupils and staff at Columbine High School in 1999. And these so-called fans of theirs are known as Columbiners. But you look at them and you think, well, they're obviously sick in some way. But that is not the case in the vast majority, because these people are not drawn to this fandom to celebrate the killers or what they've done. They are interested in the people, in those boys who ended up doing that ghastly thing, because those two boys made a big play of how they were bullied and ostracized and rejected from their school groups, and they were calling for a revolution of the dispossessed. And the Columbiners have a very similar trajectory. They tend to be people who are bullied and feel rejected and ostracized. And so they're interested in the backstory of these killers, not because they applaud what they do, but more because they're terrified at what they did. And they recognize, you know, the potential monstrousness in themselves. Interestingly, the psychologists who study this group, they point out that in coming to this fandom, it can actually benefit them, because for the first time, they find a group of other people who share that interest, albeit a niche and potentially dangerous interest. But in finding other people who have that common interest, they suddenly find a social group. And that is very good for their mental health, and it makes it much less likely that they would follow a dark path, if you like, because they can share their concerns. But there is the flip side of that, is a very small minority who do go on to emulate those killers and that fandom, because the information is available on those online fan groups. It makes it easier for that small minority to carry that kind of thing out. Mm. But they tend not to be part of the mainstream social groups in these fandoms.
So essentially, it's about finding your tribe.
It is partly about finding your tribe. Yeah, I mean, and that's sort of what life is, isn't it? To a large degree, everyone wants to find their people. I mean, I heard that phrase, you know, I finally found my people. So often in so many fandoms, talking to people who, you know, the course that they took from being a fan of something, loving something in the safety of their bedroom, and then discovering that there were other people who were like them and who loved this thing. And that phrase, "I finally found my people," that does represent that idea. You know, it's just, it's important for us to find our tribe. But having found your tribe, it doesn't have to be a tribal experience, if you see what I mean. It doesn't have to be antagonistic towards other tribes. It can be an overwhelmingly positive experience.
Researching this book, you must have come across some very odd fandoms. What stood out for you?
I just ended up not being surprised at finding fandoms in all kinds of extraordinary places. I actually became a member of a group called the Richard III Society. They call themselves Ricardians, and they are fans. Well, they would not call themselves fans, but they are supporters of the 15th century English King Richard III. And it's difficult to imagine a character in English history more monstrous than Richard III, if you believe the conventional version of history. But the Ricardians are convinced that that conventional version of history is wrong, and that Shakespeare, when he called Richard III a poisonous, bunch-backed toad, and you know all the rumours of him killing members of his family, including his nephews in the Tower, that that's all wrong. It was made up by his opponents after his death, and has just been accepted by the mainstream media. Ricardians push back against that, and they are mostly retired. They are sort of amateur historians who spend a lot of time researching into that era of history, mainly to try and overturn the traditional version and to sort of offer evidence that he was a benign king or even a great king. I don't think there's anything odd about that. That theme of pushing back against the mainstream, against the status quo, and standing up for someone who you feel was a victim is very common in all kinds of fandoms. But, you know, it's quite niche. But not odd. Niche, but not odd.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose what I find odd is that we've all got so much, most of us have got so much on in our lives, to have that obsession about another person, sometimes not even a live person, just does seem to me a little bit unusual.
Well, that's why people like that, they don't sort of advertise the fact that they're interested in this, and why they love being with other people who don't think that their interest is odd. Everyone has a passion, has an interest, and I think I very rarely thought that people's interest was unhealthy or odd, actually. When you really look at it, it's a very, very normal human passions driven by emotions, feelings, and the resolution tends to be a good one. It's just a fascinating insight into how people work, and it can seem irrational from the outside, but you know, most of what we do is irrational, isn't it?
Are you a fan of anything in particular?
Well, I was a fan of some various musicians when I was younger, but I was never part of a fandom, and I always rather regretted that, not reaching out to others who shared my love of various bands. And I mean, it was the pre-internet era, it was harder to do, but it looks like just such a great thing to do, to you know, be with others who get you. So I wish I had reached out. So I'm a sort of a fan, but without a fandom, I suppose.
Well, I think I'm a fan now of Michael Bond and of this book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on to talk to us. Absolutely fascinating. The book is called Fans, A Journey into the Psychology of Belonging. It's published by Picador, and it is by Michael Bond. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to our producer, Nora Hull. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or your preferred podcast platform. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.